We are starting week 9 of New City Catechism. And we're covering this week the first 3 commandments in the Ten Commandments. So let's just start at the top there. Your worksheet, everyone got a worksheet? A handout, whatever you want to call this thing. So, kind of like last time, there's a lot of stuff in here that maybe you can have as a resource for the future, because there's just a lot. So, we'll cover what we can. The goal of the day is I want to spend up to the last maybe 15 minutes covering the content itself of it, and then the last 15 minutes, we really want to, I got a section in the back there with some kind of probing questions of what is idolatry, other gods and such have to do with us in this modern world, and try to develop that. And then also really pushing back toward that question we had last week of the relationship between law and grace. How does this Old Covenant Ten Commandments and law in general, how are we to understand this in New Covenant in terms of grace? All right, so let's start this process with the most important thing. Let's ask God for some help here. Lord, thank you. Thank you for your word. Thank you that it's accessible, that we can all open buy a Bible for almost nothing and open the words of life. Thank you that you speak through it and you change our lives. And all we have to do is have open palms and receive from you. Help us today, have mercy on our brains, have mercy on our hearts, and let us listen as best we can to what you have to say. In your name, amen. All right, so the question for this week, I'll read the question, and we'll all read the answer together. What does God require in the first, second, and third commandments? Answer, first, that we know and trust God as the only true and living God. Second, that we avoid all idolatry and do not worship God improperly. Third, that we treat God's name with fear and reverence, honoring also his word and works. All right. So far, in the last, I think, two weeks of the catechism, we've been talking about the law already, and then specifically the Ten Commandments. Previous lessons, we discussed the purpose of the Torah, or the law in general, and of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments in particular. We've established the Torah is the revelation of Yahweh's character to his people and his holiness, and that it requires our personal, perfect, and perpetual obedience with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. This week, we're going to move forward a little bit. We're going to focus on the uniqueness of Israel's God, Yahweh, and the nature of the covenant that he made with Abraham's descendants that demand the sole devotion to him as found in the first 3 of the Ten Commandments. Anyone else need another one of these? So first we're going to talk about that covenant. If anyone had to define in a short sentence, phrase, whatever, what a covenant is, what comes to the front of your mind?
Contractual agreement.
Very good, yeah. Anything else? I think that pretty much summarizes. Here on this list, I've got several that we find in the Hebrew Scriptures, of this idea of a covenant. If you go to number 1 there first, we won't open these passages themselves, but you can look at these separately on your own. Number 1, a covenant of alliance between 2 equal parties. So a friend, or we would call this a treaty or an alliance, but a covenant is how they refer to that same agreement. It's a pact. There are terms of the covenant. Both parties hold to that covenant. If one breaches the covenant's broken and war ensues. Number 2 there, a covenant of friendship between 2 equal parties. You can think of, I think the best example is David and his friend Jonathan. that they actually make a covenant in actually several places. They make this covenant. And so it's not a treaty, it's not an alliance, this is a friendship. Very different feel of covenant. The third one there, and this is a really important one as we're looking at Yahweh's covenant with us, the covenant of marriage between two parties. So all of these so far, we have two equal parties. And this third one here really bleeds into the covenant language that we have as given in the law. The fourth one is the first one where we go into a covenant where you do not have two equal parties. You have one person that is master over the other. One person has power, one person has provision, and that's what he provides to the other. And the other person, all they do is submit to that, and they have terms of that agreement, that contract, and the two things that are required for those two in terms of Old Testament language, the master, he's responsible for giving his covenant faithfulness. In a lot of translations, you see the word steadfast love, or chesed is the Hebrew word there behind it, that has to do with him holding his part of the bargain, his side of the contract. And on the other side, the side of the vassal or the servant, you have this term emunah, or faithfulness, fidelity. We get our idea of faith in the New Testament really kind of from that idea. So it's not just a cognitive thinking, believing in something, but very much a participatory faithfulness, fidelity to a contract. Think of it in terms of number three there, the covenant of marriage. Faithfulness is not marked by something just in the mind. It's marked by your whole life being offered to the other party, right? And so that's the other side of it. So you have the one who holds the contract and provides provision to the other, and you have the other one that submits that contract. So that's number four. And number five is when we're talking about here, where he takes this same idea of this king and a servant, or a lord and a servant, and we move that into terms of Yahweh, our God, and Israel, his servant. But it's really mirroring the idea of a king and a servant, or servants. Okay, so any questions so far on the covenant? I think it's pretty straightforward, right? Okay. It's this fifth type of covenant that was established with Israel on Mount Sinai. And the two stone copies, like receipts of the covenant, which is all the old documents we find on clay tablets, are, for the most part, a huge majority of them are receipts. They are like in the, we talk a lot about the Dead Sea Scrolls findings, about finding biblical texts in there, but another huge portion of all that was paper or stone was used for a receipt. It was really important. Like, imagine having a contract with another person and not have anything to actually prove that you made that sale with another person, or that you have this title deed of land. That's what writing was actually originally kind of invented for, was to bind parties to a covenant or to an agreement. And in this case, we have two copies of the same law given on stone as receipts of the covenant. And they were given to Moses, one to be kept for each party involved, Yahweh and Israel. The covenant established various laws and ordinances that the servant was required to keep, very much like number four up there, like in the Decalogue. It listed the promises of protection and blessings from the master if the servant fulfills the terms of the covenant, as we see in Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14, it's blessings and curses. If you hold yourself to the covenant, here's the blessings that come from it. If you breach the covenant, here's the curses that come from it. And then, like I said, the promises of destruction and curses from the master if the servant's not faithful to the covenant. So this is kind of where our discussion is going to have to kind of move toward at the end here. You know, why it's important we get there. In what ways is this covenant similar to the new covenant? And in what ways is it different? But this is very much the reality of the covenant in the Old Testament. Well, okay. So getting to the first commandment itself then. Keeping in mind this exclusive covenant between the master Yahweh and his servant Israel, We come to the first and most important of his commands in our study of the Decalogue. I, Yahweh, am your God, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and you shall have no other gods before me. Yahweh's covenant with Israel is exclusive to himself, like the marriage covenant, like the number four, the king and servant covenant, is exclusive. Like Jesus said, and you can't serve two masters, right? You can't serve God and mammon, or money. Any kind of adherence to the customs or worship of another deity was strictly forbidden, not because they don't exist, and this is what we're really going to get to here, but precisely because they do exist and are infinitely inferior to him because he created them all. Yahweh is the creator of not just the universe that we see, but the universe that we don't see, the unseen world, the angels and the principalities and authorities and rulers and all these things that you see all over in Scripture. He's the creator of all that. So when you worship anything that he's created, whether it's something we see in the physical universe or it's something we don't see, an angel or what we're going to get to here is demons serving a created thing, it's a slap in the face to Yahweh, especially when he has made this covenant as the master of the universe, the creator of all things. Imagine the infidelity when we turn and serve other things. So both the Old and New Testament affirm that there are indeed other divine beings that are wrongly receiving the worship of the other nations. These first four, I'm just going to kind of read through. I think you guys just have the reference. Yeah, good.
Question?
So, yeah.
By divine, you would mean like demons, that kind of...
Yes, yeah, thank you. So, I wish I had a whiteboard up here, but we think in mathematical terms, you have a line, which goes infinitely this way, infinitely that way. We have a segment, which has a beginning and has a definite end. And we have a ray that has a beginning and has no end that way. So Yahweh is the only one that's a line. He's infinite and infinite. But the angelic beings, the divine beings that he created, have this beginning because they're created, and they're eternal, they're divine beings. I guess that's... Does that answer the question?
Yes. Okay. So somewhat, but that makes us divine as well.
It makes what?
That makes us divine.
And we're going to actually get to that too at the end here, that we have an eternal inheritance with Yahweh, right? That... And we'll get there. So these first four, starting with Deuteronomy 17:2-3. If there's found among you a man or woman who does what is evil in the sight of Yahweh your God, transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the hosts of heaven, which I have forbidden, kill him, is the final part there. But there we go. We have people already in the mix that are pushing everybody in the nation of Israel, right after this covenant's made, to worship also other deities, or to turn from Yahweh completely and serve only other deities. Both a problem. Deuteronomy 32:16-17, talking about Israel breaching this covenant. They offered sacrifices to demons, non-gods, that their fathers did not know. New ones who have only recently emerged. Your fathers did not know them. Psalm 81:9-10. There shall be no strange god among you. You shall not bow down to a foreign god. I am Yahweh your God, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Open wide your mouth, and I will fill it. And then Psalm 106:36-38 there. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons. They poured out innocent blood, the blood of their sons and their daughters. So, it's not that these things don't exist. It's that they do exist and are infinitely inferior to Yahweh. And a slap in the face to him and his covenant with us. For this next section, I think we've got a few more. If you guys want to be ready, we'll kind of pop through a bunch of these, read them back to back. The worship of other deities was a breach of the covenant and was often spoken of in terms of sexual infidelity in a marriage, in a marital covenant. So the often you see in translations, they were whoring after other gods. They were prostituting themselves to other gods. That's the language in there. It is that's not an interpretation. That's actually how he's talking about it. It's this marital infidelity. So can I get a couple of volunteers to read a few sections here? Deuteronomy 31:16. Next one.
I'll get my
turn. Okay, thank you. Judges 2:12 and then 17, not 3:17. Anyone else? Malachi 2:10-11. And then when you're ready, go for it.
Okay. Behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers. Then this people will rise and whore after the foreign gods among them in the land that they are entering, and they will forsake me and break my covenant that I have made with them.
Okay.
Judges 2:12. And they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger.
Mm-hmm. And then verse 17. Yeah.
And yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods, and bowed themselves down to them. Okay. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. Okay. They did not do as their fathers.
And in Malachi 2.
Have we not all one father? Did not one God create us? Why do we profane the covenant of our fathers by breaking faith with one another? Judah has broken faith. A detestable thing has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. Judah has desecrated the sanctuary the Lord loves by marrying the daughter of a foreign god.
Very, very explicit marital language there. Again, pointing back to the heart of that covenant. This is something very binding. Worship of a deity is inseparably attached to the customs and the ethical standards of that deity. So when an individual is unfaithful to the covenant, they're not only worshiping that deity, but also living by the ethical standards of that deity. The covenant and commands of Yahweh are spoken of as a path that he's leading his people on, which will lead to safety if they keep following it. And so it's a really beautiful part of the book of Deuteronomy is how he keeps talking about this way in which I commanded you, right? The word is just, it's a path. It's a path that he is going ahead of us on, like a king would, right? It's, I go before you. He's blazing a trail, and all we have to do is follow that path. And that's how he talks about his law, his commands. And it's a safe path. He's going ahead, we just follow. And these passages in here really kind of the next four we'll kind of look at. I think you already read 2:17. Oh, you're talking about that path. The first one up there, Deuteronomy 5:32-33, says, "You shall be careful, therefore, to do as Yahweh your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. You shall walk in all the path that Yahweh your God has commanded you." Deuteronomy 11:26-28 says, "See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commands of Yahweh your God, which I command you today. And the curse if you do not obey the commandments of Yahweh your God, but turn aside from the path I'm commanding you today to go after other gods that you have not known." So again, this is inseparably bound to the ethical standards that Yahweh gives. Because remember, like we talked about, the Torah is this expression of himself. So in the direction that he goes, we go that way. What he does, how he is, we go that way. And if you don't, you not only are just following another deity, a lesser being that he created, but also doing all the things that other nation is doing. Which is marked by every single time. Like if you, like in the book of Judges, this spiral down every time they match the customs of another another nation, and they just keep spiraling downward because Yahweh gives the perfect path for us to follow. And then that last one there, Deuteronomy 28:13-14, "And Yahweh will make you the head and not the tail, if you obey the commandments of Yahweh your God, which I command you today, being careful to do them. And if you do not turn aside from any of the words that I command you today, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods and serve them. The real problem of Israel's worship of other deities was that he had maintained only Israel as his own inheritance. He picked him. He picked Abraham and his descendants to make this covenant with. Very unique to him. And for Israel to worship any other deity was to deny the sovereignty of Yahweh over all the divine beings as Yahweh of hosts. That's what that idea there, the Lord of hosts, is the Lord of the armies, the Lord of all these other things. He's the master of them, he's the creator of them, and sovereign over them. So can I get some volunteers for these next ones? Deuteronomy 4:19. Deuteronomy 32:8-9. Exodus 15:11. And Psalm 16:5-6. We'll read Acts after that. Acts 17:29-30.
Which
okay.
Psalm 16, right?
I might have had those in switched order. I think I gave you Psalm 16, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you've got Acts 17:29. Okay, so go ahead with Deuteronomy 4:19.
And beware, lest you raise your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the hosts of heaven, you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them. Things that the Lord your God has allotted to all peoples under the whole heaven.
Deuteronomy 32:8-9.
When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, he set up boundaries for the people according to the number of the sons of Israel, for the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is allotted inheritance.
Okay, so you have this inheritance language here, and that is actually a textual problem. Does anyone else have a different translation of that one? Specifically at verse 8 there.
You don't like my version?
According to the number of the sons of. What translation do you have? What translation do you have? Yeah.
Mine is NIV.
NIV? Anybody have ESV by chance? Go ahead, verse 8.
When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the numbers of the sons of God.
Okay, so there's an early textual issue there between the sons of Israel and sons of God. But sons of God, as we have in several places in the Old Testament, are these divine beings. Okay, so like we have in Job, the sons of God. And several places in Deuteronomy, several places in the Psalms. That the borders of the nations were fixed according to the number of the sons of God. Whatever we want to call that, the divine beings, right? And Yahweh takes this one portion, like specifically for himself. Everything belongs to him. But he specifically takes Abraham and his descendants as his own that he makes that covenant with. He doesn't make this covenant with anybody else. His goal is that through this one man, this old man that can't produce anymore, that he would bless the entire world through him. Right? So not to have that same covenant with everybody at the beginning, but that through that one nation, the whole world would be gained. Right? And that's really the story that we see in the church, too. And then the next one, I forget where we're at there, Exodus 15.
Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders?
Good. Psalm 16, 5 through 6.
The Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. You hold my lot. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance.
He had language there of the boundary lines of what someone's been given in inheritance, right? That this is Yahweh's his inheritance. Pretty beautiful little psalm there. And then the Acts 17 one.
Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent.
Again. So these four I have in bold after that. We don't have time to read these, but they're some of the most really striking and most beautiful passages in the Bible, and it's when Yahweh is speaking for himself, when he's like, it's mind-blowing to think of abandoning the God of the universe to worship other things. And when he stands up and speaks for himself, like, what in the world are you thinking? Don't you know who I am? There's these four kind of those, or the first three especially, are these statements of Yahweh, like, don't you realize who I am? I'm just going to read one of those three, and if you can afterward, I think it's very very fruitful to look at it. Let's go Isaiah 44:6. Thus says Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts. I am the first, and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. Who is like me? Let him proclaim it. Let him declare and set it before me, since I appointed an ancient people. Let them declare what is to come and what will happen. Fear not, nor be afraid. Have I not told you from of old and declared it? Are you not my witnesses? Is there a God beside me? There is no rock. I know of not any. All who fashion idols, and here we get into the second commandment, all who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do no profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know that they may be put to shame. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble, let them stand forth. They shall be terrified. They shall be put to shame together. The ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. Or the carpenter stretches a line. He marks it out with a pencil. He shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into the figure of a man with the beauty of a man to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar and the rain nourishes it. Catch this mockery yet? Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes a part of it and he warms himself. So the same thing he just created a deity with, he's taking the other part of it and burning it. And warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread up. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the half he eats meals, eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself on the fire. And he says, aha, I'm warm. I have seen the fire. And the rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. They know nothing, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes so they cannot see, and their hearts so they can't understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it I burned in the fire, I also baked bread on the coals, I roasted meat and have eaten. And shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. And so forth, and this just keeps going. Yeah, I'm going to go to verse 21. Remember these things, Jacob and Israel, for you are my servant. I formed you. Just like the same language here, forming these idols. I formed you. I formed you. You are my servant. O Israel, you will not be forgotten by me. I have blotted out your transgressions like a cloud and your sins like mist. Return to me, for I redeemed you. Sing, O heavens, for Yahweh has done it. Shout, O depths of the earth. Break forth into singing, O mountains, O forests, and every tree in it. For Yahweh has redeemed Jacob and will be glorified in Israel. Thus says Yahweh, your Redeemer, who formed you from the womb. And I can keep going on that one. I love these passages and the next two as well. But just this contrast, and that's what we're going to be jumping into on this. So we have established in the first commandment that worshiping of any other deity that he created is absolutely forbidden because he's the only creator. He's the only one that worship is due. And when you do, not only are you following after them, but you're following the customs too. You're not walking that path that he's made to safety, to real security as a human. That's the only path to that, defining our identity as his servant. And so now this extra mockery of the second commandment of making an idol, making an image, and worshiping it. And we saw that in that first one there, this contrast of the immortal God that created everything, and us worshiping a little block of wood that we warm ourselves over. So the second commandment, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that's in heaven above or the earth beneath or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love, that's that word there, steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So the ban on idols or images was grounded in the truth that Yahweh cannot be localized in a shape or an object to then be summoned and controlled by a worshiper. That was the idea of creating an idol, is that you could somehow, very much like a genie, and actually that's a legitimate parallel in the ancient Near East, that idea of a genie, of summoning a deity. If you know their name, you can master them. You can have them do what you want. That was the understanding of this. And for this reason, Yahweh made it a point to reveal himself in darkness on the mountain so that no one could identify him with any other object on earth or in the heavens and fashion an idol accordingly. Again, we'll have to, you have to read this one separately, but the whole passage in Deuteronomy 4, 6 through 24, he's describing his revelation of himself on Mount Sinai and specifically saying, I showed up in cloud, in gloom, in fire, so that you couldn't look around and see the stars and say, oh, that must be our God. Or see the moon and say, oh, that must be our God. Or see anything else. He shrouded himself in darkness so that when they experienced him, they couldn't localize it to a thing and say, this is our God. But the only thing that he likens himself to is fire. And imagine trying to create fire as an idol. Very specifically revealing himself in that way because of this propensity that we have of trying to limit him and make him our own, unfortunately. Like the first commandment, the ban on idols was not put in place because other deities don't exist. Like you mentioned, the difference between the God, the eternal, and the deities, these other angelic beings or demons that we saw, not because they don't exist, but because the worship of any deity through an idol or image was the worship of a lesser deity and a lack of acknowledgement of the sovereignty of Yahweh over all deities. So not only is that not okay to worship another deity through an idol, but he's specific about you can't have an image of me, even if it's the real God of the universe. You can't have an image of me either, an idol of me, because that's not okay. You can't control me in the way that you think you can control. To kind of jump on a couple other things we already talked about, the reality of the demons behind idols. We have 1 Corinthians 8 and 1 Corinthians 10 when Paul is talking about this meat sacrifice to idols. He's very specific about it, saying it's not that they're not there. He's very specific and says that actually when you are partaking, you're sharing in you're participating with demons. You're sharing in the table with demons. And you can't share in the table of the Lord and the table of demons at the same time. Again, lots of things you can kind of look at afterwards, I guess. But Yahweh's disgust for idolatry is expressed in this contrast of himself as the living God, the eternal God, with the works of human hands, like we read in that other one. There's a whole bunch of them here, just little snippets that just this mockery of this situation that people were finding themselves in worshiping the things that they make. Yahweh deliberately revealed himself to his people in darkness so that no image could be associated with his self-revelation. This is because he already made an image for himself. And we kind of already talked about this one a few weeks back. Who is and what is God's, Yahweh's, image in the universe? He already made it. He, if you want to call localizing, like we talked about that idol, he localizes himself. He makes his image in humans. And we are the expression, or the intended expression, of Yahweh. That's what we're here for. And after the fall, that image, that idol, if you want to call it that, it's not the same thing, but that image is degraded. And when we sin, when we fall, and we go off that path, then we are false representatives as the image of Yahweh. And that's really why our bodies don't belong to us. It's not just a sin against ourselves or our own bodies, but it's a sin against Yahweh when we sin, because we are his image. We are his representatives. And I just have on there Genesis 1, 26 and 27, let us make man in our image. Genesis 9, 6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. Romans 8, 29, for those whom he foreknew, and we're getting the New Testament here, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. That's the redeeming of the image of God in humans, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. 1 Corinthians 11, 7, for a man ought not to cover his head, since he's the image and glory of God. 1 Corinthians 15, 49, as we bear the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. Beautiful. And we all, the next one there, 2 Corinthians 3, 18, we, glory of Yahweh, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. And the last one there, 2 Corinthians 4, 4. In their case, talking about people outside the church or fallen Christians, in their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. So we have this story and coming into the new covenant of the restoration of this, the concept of the second commandment. And that brings us to the third one here, which I think is often misunderstood or limited to smaller things that you can more easily master, like not saying the wrong words, not saying the name of Yahweh in demeaning ways. Those are the ways that we normally think of breaking that third commandment. You shall not bear the name of Yahweh, your God, in vain. For Yahweh will not hold him guiltless who bears his name in vain. The phrase, to bear the name of Yahweh, has been interpreted variously, since there's not much in the context there to help determine its meaning. The word, often translated to take the name, literally means like to lift up. So that's hence the bearing the name, lift up his name. There are several possible interpretations. Got a few categories here. Taking the name as representing Yahweh. Leviticus 21:6. They shall be holy to their God and not profane the name of their God. For they offer Yahweh's food offerings, the bread of their God. Therefore they shall be holy. And representatives, the Levites, the priests, as representatives. Deuteronomy 28:10. All the peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of Yahweh, and they shall be afraid of you, representatives. This one will say, Isaiah 44:5. This one will say, I am Yahweh's. Another will call on the name of Jacob. Another name himself after Jacob. And another will write on his hand, Yahweh's. I belong to Yahweh. And name himself by the name of Israel. And then the last one there, Micah 4:5. For all the peoples walk each in the name of its God, but we walk in the name of Yahweh, our God, forever and ever, as representatives. The second one there, taking the name as speaking the name or calling on his presence. So that's kind of the normal one where we think of using his name in the wrong context. Right? Exodus 23:13. Pay attention to all that I have said to you, and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips. Psalm 16:4. The sorrows of those who run after another god shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out or take their names on my lips. It's binding of in a covenant with another being. Psalm 50:16. But to the wicked, God says, what right do you have to recite my statutes or to take, lift up, my covenant on your lips? Leviticus 19:12. You shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. So the name of Yahweh for the Israelites was to be used in covenant language. It was to be used in blessings. It was even used in curses. Think of Elisha when he's cursing these kids that are mocking him, and the two bears come out and maul him. It says he curses them in the name of Yahweh, right? So as a prophet, as a priest, bless and curse in the name of Yahweh. You bind yourself to a covenant or to other things in the name of Yahweh as a Israelite. And it's binding because what better oath can you make than to say, as Yahweh's watching it, I'm going to keep this promise. Lots of other ones on there. You can only find like two or three times in all the Old Testament where it actually says, I think two times, where it says to take the name of Yahweh. And the one time that's in there is as, Psalm 139:20. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. They lift up your name. So the parallel there is they're mocking him. They speak against him maliciously. They bear his name in vain. They talk about him with vanity or lightly, whatever you want to call it. So that's kind of the idea there. But really, and then that third one there, taking the name as speaking for Yahweh. Like I said, blessing in his name, cursing his name, or in the case of Deuteronomy 18 here, but the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name that I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that same prophet shall die. So each of these applications of the third commandment speak to the importance of being aware as his people that we are his representatives. And when we speak, when we represent him as something that he is not, or treat our covenant with him lightly, it's blasphemy. And it's the gravest of sins. We as humans in general, and as his people in specific, are given the incredible responsibility of being his image and representatives. So just, I hope you got a little extra time. I don't have my... All right. Just all right. I know that's kind of a lot in a row there. Just to unpack some of that. Got three different sections of questions here. The first one being that first commandment. We are in a very different society. We don't build, in general, most people don't build little things to worship. Maybe at least to represent a deity, like carve it and make it look like something else. We don't do that. We don't, in general, have other gods. In fact, we don't even have any for a lot of people here in America. Right? We don't even adhere to any deity. We are all there is for a lot of people. That's the opinion of a lot of people. So how, in this 21st century world that we live in, how do we find ourselves, or other people around us, find ourselves breaking this first commandment and have other gods before Yahweh? It's an open question.
Ourselves.
Okay? Ourselves. Explain yourself.
Well, you can love yourself vanity. You could think so highly of yourself that, you know, you end up essentially worshiping your looks, your physique.
Mm-hmm. Good. Any others?
Well, the Darwinists, or those who are naturalists, also say that man is the measure of the epitome of evolution. So in that, they are worshiping themselves and not even really aware of it.
Yeah, very, very good. the humanist, right?
The people who worship nature above humanity.
Good.
This might be a little bit excessive, but I when a student is talking to me, I'm not in a Christian school. When a student is talking to me and they say, "Oh my God," my visceral response is to say, "No, I am not." And I do that all the time, and some of them have figured that out and stuff. And that's not like saying I think they're actually calling me God, but I think for me it bothers me so much that that there could ever be any misconstruing of it. I will immediately say no, I'm not your God. And sometimes they always stop and stare at me and back off.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe that's ridiculous of me. But
that's, I think that's a good expression of, I mean, more the third command there, where this lightly using or referring to the God of the universe in some kind of flippant way, like you would say, oops, or something like that, you know.
Recently I heard a message, they were talking about the fact that the things today that we have gods are those things which provide us with power, or purpose, or providence, or with preoccupation.
Very good. Especially that preoccupation in our society, I think, is a huge one right now. That's entertainment media.
A little sidebar on that, in Luke, Jesus is talking about, he makes a statement that watch out for it. It's one of the most severe watch out for's phrases. Watch out for dissipation, orgies, and drunkenness.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure what dissipation meant. I looked it up. It's like you drop food coloring in water and it dissipates, and just, and the two words in our dictionary that are closely related with that are entertainment and amusement.
Those are definitely deities there for us. Yeah, if you think of, in terms of this covenant, why did we bind ourselves to the covenant with Yahweh in the first place? He provides for us. That's his name that he's given, Yahweh who provides. You know, he is that, to go back to the terms of covenant, the king and the servant, he provides protection from the outside. He provides protection from the inside. He supplies provisions. He keeps, in terms of a king, keeps other countries from invading, all those types of things. Yahweh provides us with everything we need. He provides us with spiritual nourishment. He gives us that path to go on. And if we walk down that path with him, that's all we need in our souls. And so when we turn and try to find something else to satisfy the soul, like St. Augustine says, our hearts are restless until they find the rest in him. Where that's how he made us. He made us to be aching for him. And when we try to find other ways to satisfy that, we are doing the same exact thing. We're going off that path to the right or to the left and leaving him behind. So how is that much different than serving another god in this context? We're leaving the path that he gave and seeking provision somewhere else.
Micah, I think too, like in our nation, when we want to take out under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, are we, you know, it's like how important it is that we stand up, because you take that out, you're opening up a void, you know, and in our nation, we think it's not that big a deal, so they take the Ten Commandments down or all these things, but it's like, it's just opening up a hole without God in our soul.
I can see that.
As a nation.
And on the other side of that is also it's expressing what is going on in that nation too. Like if that's the desire of the nation to no longer be under God, it's not just keeping those things in public that's going to return us to God, but we need a revival. We need, the nation has to come back to life. And the only way that happens is through the church.
When I have those thoughts come through my mind, I have to remind myself, my citizenship is in heaven.
Yeah, very good.
I am merely a sojourner, a traveler through this country.
Yeah.
I do not belong to this country.
Mm-hmm.
And though they followed Christ and God at one time, they may choose not to later, but that is not a direct impact on their particular life.
We as a Christian, we are a minute embassy of God. As Paul talks about it, as ambassadors.
I don't want to open up more than what I'm seeing here. Uh-huh. This does open up a bigger question of why do we worship Yahweh?
Yeah, very good.
Why
what do you think?
Is that not another name for Islam, for Judaism, for the other gods in other religions are out there? How do we know that Yahweh is the only God? And the discussion, we don't have that kind of time, but this opens that up, and that's a really interesting.
It is very, very interesting, and especially like in terms of the Muslim discussion, where they stem from Muslims are an offshoot of Christian heresy. That's why you find in the Quran itself references to texts about Jesus that we don't have in our canon. They're outside. They're Gnostic texts. They talk about Jesus making sparrows from the clay, and it's Christian influence. And they began originally as Christians, and slowly moved away completely from acknowledging Jesus as divine, as God Himself, and just being what we talked about, that monotheistic, not being able to express Jesus as the image of God. And so they very much started from that same root. So if that's the case, then all these texts that talk about Allah, they think it's very much like Jesus was talking about the Samaritan woman, right? What you worship what you don't know. It's not that they are worshiping, they're trying to worship the same God, but they don't know Him. And so they are going off to that side because He made this path. And so when they're not following that path, they're not going after the only true God, the living God. They're going somewhere else thinking they're following Him. Like Paul, when he was thinking he was following Yahweh and persecuting the church, he's going elsewhere, right? Second question on there. What people or things do we run to? We talked about, we hit lots of this already, but do we run to for help, comfort, or a big one, coping, entertainment, right? I think we covered that one enough. Unless anyone wants to add to that question. I think that was pretty good. So then we talked about last week all these commands. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. What's the positive aspect of the command then? So if the command, first commandment is saying don't worship other gods, the positive aspect is saying do what? Worship Yahweh only, right? Okay, so this one's an easy one. We'll get to some of the other ones, maybe a little more difficult to piece through. Positive aspect of this command is Yahweh is the only one who receives or who is to receive worship. He is the only one that's the creator of the universe. There are other beings, indeed, but He made them. They're infinitely inferior. So the positive aspect is He's your God, He's the only God, worship Him only. On that second one there, the second commandment, can we find ourselves guilty of making idols to represent God or another God? It's a little more tricky in our culture. Do we try to localize God or another God through making something? Do we have this idea of a genie where you rub the lamp and make your wish? In what ways do we do?
Bank account?
Okay, go ahead. Explain.
Finding security and how much money you have, or being anxious because you don't have
it. Yeah, absolutely.
And taking that a step further with, money, in general, finances or any kind of life stress, just get carried away with it that you end up turning away.
Mm-hmm.
And all your focus is on that.
Yeah. What is it?
Facebook.
Oh, there we go. Okay, so I think all of these are really getting at why would people feel like they need to make something physical to represent an invisible deity? That really gets at something here. We are materialists at heart. We want to sense everything. I want to be able to feel, taste, see, hear. I want to be able to experience it right here, and not have something that I experience in my spirit. I don't want to have something invisible, not tangible. That's what it really comes down to. I want something tangible. Bank account, I really get to that. Bank account, not in itself, but that it buys the tangible things, the entertainment and everything else. So in a sense, that is our deity that we run to, is this unlimited funds that we want. And the idol are the things themselves that we try to localize and find a delight in and find our purpose in, when we are already the localization of God. Right? We experience Him in spirit, and we don't need a thing to do or see in order to experience Him.
Yeah, like it just seems like all the time, and probably all of us, is, Lord, I trust in You. And then we turn and do anything else.
you know,
we want to trust Him, and yet we take anything, that takes place like that.
It's true. We've just got a couple more minutes here. I wanted to drill home this law, this first three that we're looking at. We talked about this is the expression of Yahweh. He doesn't change. We read that in one of the passages, and it's in the other ones too, the bold ones that I talked about. Read those. Yahweh is the immortal God. He's the creator of all things. He doesn't change. So if that's the case, and He expressed Himself in this way through the law, what things are we seeing through the laws? What is this path that He made that we're still following down? It doesn't look the same. We don't have the same Levitical customs in place to be able to be sanctified and such. We don't have the same ceremonial laws. We don't wear the same clothing because it's a sin to do this or this. We don't have all those things, but it's still the same path. And so the law is just as much binding because it's the only path to Him, because He made that path.
I'm going to speak up. The law is not our path. Jesus Christ and His death and resurrection are our path, and He did not resurrect us in order to follow the law, but the law is a guide to our lives. And I have to make sure
when you made
that statement, I want to make that clear.
I understand what you're saying. That's what I mean, like, the law is His expression of Himself. It's not that the law in itself is something that's going to get you to Him. It's because He's ahead. That's what makes the path good. He's the one that's ahead of you on that path. That's what makes the law good, the expression of Himself. Because turning to the right, the left, is like we talked about in Old Testament terminology, that's how you find death. I think we'll have to explore this a little more in the next couple weeks too. There's this tension, right? Between, like, the last question there I tried to get to was it's law and grace, where He created us to be His image bearers. That means being certain things, becoming certain things. He created us as His own workmanship, created in Christ to what? To work that out, to show Him the world around us. We are His image. So, again, we'll get a little more into this, I think, probably in the next couple of weeks, but it's a very important discussion. We have that. Let's pray real quick and conclude. Went a little bit over. Lord, thank You again for Your revelation of Yourself in Your law, in Your attributes. That You want us for Yourself, and You will have nothing else in our lives. Help us to conform to that, to worship You only, to model ourselves after You only, to not try to localize You in other things and to find delight and pleasure in the material universe, because we can't grasp You because You're so infinite. And help us to bear Your image rightly in this world around us, to be the representatives that You made us to be. Thank You. Amen.